Okay, good afternoon. Today we are almost close to the end of this course. We should go a little bit more into the natural side of natural computing, so outside the computer. And what do I do? Molecular computing is one of the maybe most promising or at least most interesting ways how to deal with these possibilities, which are implied partially by what we have done before, and most or much more in by all these advances which have been achieved by the nanotechnology in the last 20 years or so. But because this was last time a little bit cut short, we should maybe have a look also on DNA computing. So we were talking about Adelman's solution, which was actually a very big step, a key experiment in the field. Yeah, also it was working essentially for this kind of five city problem. It was a little bit discouraging in the sense that you can easily shows that already for problems which can be done by any laptop, you would need much more DNA than available in all living beings maybe. And so it was not really an option to go to, but it is clear that it was a little bit too brute force and too much determined by the doability of such experiments in the first place, such that everything what we have learned here in this course has been has been ignored. Yeah? That it's not necessary to really realize all the possible solution and then just take out the one which is good, but that even with a couple of ants or a couple of individuals in a genetic pool, you can get to very good solutions, and especially if the problem is not particularly hard, then you do not need too many. And so the hope is, of course, if the problem is harder and you really have now not like 20 ants or let's say maybe 40 individuals in a population, but you can really think of trillions or more of individuals, then maybe these problems will really become solvable. And in this way, it's possible to think of just better algorithms for a DNA computer that doesn't test all combinations of individuals, but just tries to move the population just in the same way as we did in the computer, move the population in a better direction. And that's an obvious possibility. And after this Adelman experiment, people have proposed it, and more recently there's also a chance to maybe not really arrive at the interesting solution, but to give a little bit more life to these type of approaches. So there is this idea of a DNA genetic algorithm, so it's exactly the same what you do in a computer, but now with real genes. So there are some complications which in order to even clarify, not to solve, I would probably need some years of study of bioinformatics. So I'm not really an expert, and that's why it's maybe a good idea not to present it. But we can just give some kind of evidence that this is possible to perform a certain, to a certain extent, what is also done in a computer with these genetic strings. And also, maybe in a living being, it is made sure that these operations are not really harming the genetic code and are dealt with in a very conservative way. It's of course possible to use these restriction enzymes in a way as to implement our genetic operators. So what is, for example, interesting is this kind of hairpin formation. So there are in the double strand of the DNA these kind of palindromic regions, meaning it's not really the same, but in reverse complement, such that there is a possibility to fold a part away. So what is outside here doesn't really matter. It could be also a much longer chain, but there is this kind of neck which is formed and which can be easily used to cut parts of the DNA just out of the string without really, if you make sure that it's connected at this position, without really changing the integrity of the string. So in this sense, both mutations in the sense of inserting bits or of changing maybe bits can be realized, but so in living cells there are also mechanisms. So if you want to exchange maybe the gray ones here by some other type of code, then what you need to do is to get somewhere this piece of code and to attach it there. So maybe some molecules can really do the attachment, but delivery has to be organized in some way. And we know a little bit about this kind of transport RNAs, which are able to perform such tasks. But I guess to get everything really under control is still a kind of a problem. But what you can do is you can take your whatever problem you have, yeah, encode it in such a way that there are these kind of service regions in between the meaningful code regions, and by these service regions you can at least imagine that it's possible to handle these bits. And if you maybe not considering the computation time which you really need, because these different steps usually take quite a while, you can already string together I think up to 600 base pairs, and they need to have some kind of service regions to be able to attach other molecules either for cutting or for recombining, so in this way you can deal with 30 node problems, which is already quite interesting. And everything is really, so this is, it's not very new, it's 2002. So we will see some more recent papers. So everything seems to be quite manageable. Also, it seems that the other possibility, which I not really discussed last time, but which was just mentioned, that maybe it's better not to use the standard genetic algorithm, but to use this kind of formation of certain structures really to perform explicit calculations. That's another option, which is even working on a more fine scale. What is a little bit speaking against this possibility of using really this kind of micro machines is their unreliability. So there are some kind of experiments where you can show that things are working, but what you find is that you get to reliabilities of 80% or something like this, and that's not really what you are looking for. But if you have this kind of real genetic algorithm, then a reliability of 80% is not really intolerable, in the sense that there are just 20% of individuals which will not pass the fitness check, so the algorithm could in principle work quite well. Of course, that's the main, or one of the main problems is how to determine fitness. So we had last time this slide here. So in order to create new individuals for the next generation, you do this denaturation, so you heat up the strands of the genomes, such that they disintegrate into two parts, and then you cool it down again, and so you can recomplete both, and you have two individuals in this way by PCR. This denaturation temperature, when the molecule leaves its natural form, depends very much on the content of the base pairs in a particular string. So if usually it's more or less you have the same probability for AT and CG, but there are samples where there is the dominance of one of these, or you can just artificially study these examples, and then you see that it's a wide range, not only for each single one, but for also the different types in this direction. So for example, if you have an minimization problem, like this traveling salesman problem, you can just encode certain properties in the amount of AT in contrast to CG. And then if you heat up this soup or the test tube, then at first this AT will disintegrate and be therefore ready for a reduplication. Such that it's very similar to roulette wheel or to, that there's just a higher chance for these ones which have more AT and or which by combination or recombination accumulated more AT, that they will break up earlier and therefore can be selected. So they just will take overhand and you throw away half of the content of the test tube, and you know that those which have reproduced will be the ones on this side. Obviously, this gives the solution for the all ones problem. So if you encode one by AT, then in this way, just by giving some kind of relative advantage to the AT bits and having some kind of exchange between molecules, you will end up with DNA strands which mostly will have AT only. It's a little bit questionable how you can extend this kind of procedure for other types of problems, obviously. Also, in some cases, like in the traveling salesman problems, this makes sense, that those strands which have, on average, so to say, the most AT, they will be the shortest, and you can encode in this way the properties of the problem. In this sense, what you get here is not exactly the genetic algorithm, where the type of encoding, except maybe how possible schema are encoded on the string, had not really any effect on the selection. It was everything had to be translated via the fitness function, and you could think of fitness function which completely which interprets strings in a completely different way. So here it's really acting on the strings themselves. So it's more like this kind of evolutionary algorithm. Once you are working with genes, it's maybe easier to say that it's still a genetic algorithm. The other possibility, which is mentioned here in this particular paper, is that you do the same idea as Edelman, that you have some kind of tags which you can attach by complementarity matching to the strings which you are interested to see. And so maybe by several steps you can also select in the very same way as Edelman did this, those molecules out of the test tubes that are satisfying your requirements without really requiring that they are satisfying all of them, but you just enhance those which are better than other ones. So if you have this kind of immobilization possibility, that you have some kind of target and there are some tags attached to this marker, as these tags contain a string of DNA, which is complementary to what you have in your individuals, then these individuals become also attached to the support, and in this way, there is a possibility just to wash away the other ones and keep only the few ones which are good in this sense. So you will be able to produce more if maybe just a few can be selected in this way. This is never a problem because you have this kind of PCR which produces exponentially many new individuals in your population. So another funny way which illustrates a little bit how to play with DNA molecules in a type of Lego cubes was just think last year, where there were some maybe kind of standard experiments but represented in a very nice way. And apparently also quite successful in the sense that you have really this kind of predicate logic implemented by molecules. And so you have a number of different types of objects you are dealing with. So there are facts like bound predicates. There are rules which accept a certain input and make a statement about this input. And of course, we would like to have queries in order to find out really whether these statements are true for a particular input. And so the question is how you can really deal with it and it in a context of real genetic molecules. Again, this is not really very efficient what you get here. So it takes like, I don't know, a minute minimally, and in some of the critical cases where it's not so easy to distinguish between the different types of molecules, it takes much longer. So what you do is, again, you have this kind of service areas in your encodings of these particular logic objects on a DNA string. And in addition, you have these bits here, P or Q, that carry the information, which is just a short piece of nucleate bases that encode whatever information you want to have encoded. And so the idea is simply, so if you have this kind of application of a proposition to a query, then you need to have this kind of asymmetric shapes which match to each other. And as soon as they do so, you should be able to produce an answer. No? And for this purpose, you need to have some, to generate some specific molecules which are able, once these two ends have met, to detect this or lead to some kind of cut of the molecule. They can do this even in this kind of asymmetric way. And so you are left with a short bit of code, which is just telling you that the answer is yes. Yeah. So if they never really meet or if the cut doesn't work, then these bits will be rare. And if you put this to an it's just here for the example, to an electrophoresis, then these short bits signifying yes will just have traveled farther away. And you can clearly see there are quite a few of them. And you have this mark by their trace in the electric field which is applied here. So if you want to transform an implication into a new query, now you can have this kind of two coding bits over here. And for later uses, you attach here this kind of hairpin structure out there. And again, if there is some query, then these two bits match. The restrictor molecule or jumps in, cuts this bit, and this is a very specifically designed molecule, which, and of course, also these service areas have been matched to this molecule, such that exactly the green bit remains. And then you need some kind of complementary material, which should be longer than those bits which you have here, and which matches this support area very well. So this can be constructed, and you get some other query as you had before in this case. So you have, so to say, translated by applying a rule one query to another question. And by this you can now make some tests which are not really very spectacular in their logical content, but if you have this kind of questions that you have a certain predicate which is applied to the constant Socrates, that Socrates is a man, then you can really answer this in the same way by having a query whether somebody is a man, and you get finally the answer yes, just by always having acting the same restriction molecule that separates bits and is in a sense realizing the grammar that is specified by these different types of proteins. So there are some limits here, obviously, where you have to string together these molecules in order to encode the information. It works, the reaction time is quite large in some cases, sometimes an hour or so. It depends a little bit on the degree of separation you want to have. You can, of course, stop already earlier. You don't need this big separation. But a minute is the absolute minimum which you can achieve here. And as long as you don't have faster methods to change to check the length of an remaining bit, whether it's either 16 nodes or 26 or 17 nodes, then you will not be able to deal with it. What is interesting in this way, so if, for example, if you have a kind of a question, if you ask for Zeus or something like this, which was not really encoded, or which requires, in order to be interpreted, a rule which is not there, then, like in these examples which given here, then the answer is no, so you don't get any kind of wrong answers. You have some kind of default answer, which is just given by this unary coding of the output, meaning if there is some kind of positive answer, you get a yes, and also all the other cases, either if the predicate is not true or if there is no deduction possible in this rule set, then you are left with a no answer. Well, there's just no output produced from the system, and that was it. I'm not really sure about the applicability of these procedures to more challenging problems, but there are some other, maybe less DNA-based types of computation, which recently have been explored and which seem to be much more striking. At least they produce much more colorful pictures. So this is just some kind of an now we are at an even lower level, so to say, of length scales, an illustration of the implementation of an circuit just by some kind of chemical reactions. In a sense, what you produce is here is an AND gate or an OR gate or some combination of these by the interaction of some chemicals. And the nice thing is that you really have a very small number of molecules. So these questions like input, output, and also by input, also the control, can really be realized technically, although it's not really visible, but it's obvious that you can just have some kind of output from maybe some other unit or some direct input to the system, which consists of a few ions, maybe in a solution, for example. And then you have this kind of, it's not really a silicon wafer like in a computer, but just a glass wafer, and attached to this there are some kind of organometal compounds having an head of a metal, here in this case osmium and ruthenium, I think. So they are forming a regular lattice, and as soon as they interact with some other substances, they may change their own or maybe also the ionic configuration of these inputs. So here, for example, there is an iron atom arriving, which has three electrons missing. And so because of these metals interact very easily electrically, the iron, by this encounter, can catch one more electron and is less positive in this way. And if it's now continuing to a neighboring plate with ruthenium atoms, then it will have some effect on their electric configuration. And this can be measured or can be seen, so to say, by a slight change of the reflectancy of this output unit here. If you light some laser or sheet some laser light to it, and you see this change in reflectance, which can be detected by some diodes, and yield in reliable results. So there's the possibility that you have some from some other unit again, the output of some cerium ions, and they have just the effect that if they are there, then they revert this effect of the iron, and if the iron has still this old polarity, then it will not affect the ruthenium. So in this way, you have a kind of a gate, which will just stop this output, and so it's a similar structure as in a transistor. Also, you have here also this kind of effect of water. So the water may, if you have, may either also have the same effect on the ruthenium, or it will also be able, if it's increased in a controlled way, to wash away this cerium, so that on this time scale, that this kind of microscopic or nanoscopic flow your processes take, you will be able to switch between these different possibilities, change inputs. And so even if it's just diffusion or if there's a small drift in the delivery of these different components here, there will definitely be some quick input and output changes. So but still, there's a lot of matter transport involved here. Also, these are solvable problems. It's a little bit hard to understand how you will really arrive at a workable procedure. But on the other hand, there was this idea of amorphous computing. So this is not really related to molecular computing. It's just this idea that you have clouds, we would say today, of processors, and they interact in some way. And the question is, if you don't tell them exactly a protocol by which they interact, or if you don't specify the topology, is there any chance that they do something meaningful? I'm not really sure what happened to this amorphous computing business, which was interesting a couple of years ago. It's still some kind of approach to describe the complexity of the internet. But what is interesting is that these goals which have been formulated in the community of amorphous computing, that they are very much applicable to what we should expect in this kind of nanoscopic regions, where there's no chance really to tell each of the devices what to do. It's hard to think of wires from one part to the other, so the communication will be mainly locally. And you have really to rely on some kind of emergent or self-organizing behaviors, in the sense that not all of these systems can do all possible tasks, but you really have to exploit the natural behavior of them. And because this kind of structure formation, which has already been studied by Richard Feynman, like 60 years ago, has so much rich opportunities, and there's a big likelihood that for a lot of or most of the computational problems we are dealing with, there is a chance to find a structure. So this is just some example of the amorphous computing. We have this kind of maybe very simple types of computers which are interconnected just to their neighbors. So things like this are also very interesting for modular robots that are able not only to find this kind of pattern forming interactions, or that each one tells its neighbor, I'm surrounded by red ones, maybe you join. Yeah? And if this is controlled in some local way in an appropriate fashion, then you will see this kind of pattern formation. But in robots, it's not only that they talk to their neighbors, but they can also find ways of interacting with their neighbors, such that larger structures of robots change. And also in this way, of course, the neighborhood will not be constant. So this possibility will not be given here, but we see that there are this kind of interesting possibility of pattern formation, just if they have very simple rules by how to react, or and if they have not the same protocols and they will probably not understand a lot of things, but you find these pattern formation ones. So this is more this type of robotic example, where there's also just a small interaction between the ones. So if there's maybe a curvature induced, then this curvature spreads. For example, if some kind of micro-actuator changes its angle, then this curvature will propagate it along a structure, and maybe you can, from this kind of ring structure, which has certain mechanical properties, you can go to this more dense and possibly more supportive structure if this is needed in a certain operation of this device. So things like this have been discussed maybe for airplane wings and so on. And illustrate just one other facet of this one. So it's even more interesting if you can now take these ideas from amorphous computing and go to this nanoscopic world of single molecules, typically with some kind of design properties. And here's a very nice experiment which just recently appeared, where these possibilities to have maybe not really billions or trillions of, but at least a larger number of atoms reacting at the same time and doing meaningful computations without having some kind of external control. So they really have these different types of performing some kind or representing logic gates or calculating Voronoi diagrams or maybe also useful for some kind of specific applications as understanding growth of cells or simulating actually growth of cells. So these are these colorful pictures for this topic. So the idea is simply you have an some kind of a support down here, and fixed to this support they have, in this case, not just this kind of single layer but a double layer of molecules and or of nodes, let's say. Each of the nodes is made up of one of these molecules. You have just standard atoms, chlorine and nitrogen and carbon, with this particular configuration. And the interesting point about these molecules is that they can change the attractiveness of the electrons to different parts of the molecules, and this can be switched by giving some kind of input voltage. So you have this kind of tip here, which is just made from some metal atoms and which is connected or forms, so to say, the important part of this scanning tunneling microscope, and which can, so to say, sense the potential which is formed by these different molecules. So what you get is independence on what configuration these molecules has at a certain time. You have different types of potentials you can measure here, whether it's more positive in this direction or maybe more weaker in total. So this is one point that you can really store, like in the DNA, so to say, 2 bits per node. And the other interesting point is that independence on what kind of state these units have, they also will interact in a different way. So interaction means simply that they are connected more strongly to their neighbors in a certain way. So there is some kind of possibility for a transport of current from them to the neighbor. If the potential is very deep here in between two of them, then this will be not possible and they will be essentially disconnected. And so just by moving back and forth this tip of this microscope needle parallel to the surface, you can scan and you get a picture like this, which are then translated by this color code into these more visible parts here. And then you can just analyze from what you know, either from the theory or what the dynamics of the system tells you. So what you see is, this looks a little bit like a woolen scarf or something like this. There are different directions here. And this is reflected in different connection patterns. So they have maybe this kind of ladder structure, or maybe this kind of square maze, or more densely connected patterns in different types. So that means these atoms will also in this way perform different interactions with each other. So if you change one, then in some cases this will maybe just stay isolated, or in other cases this can, if it has strong connections, it can also change neighbors. And then of course it depends to which of these four states the neighbor is changed. And this has been studied here, and you find a lot of very funny examples what you can really do with these single molecules, and apparently without much effort. Once of course you have set up this system, it has also some kind of a long time constant in as compared to what you might need in such domains, in the sense that you really have to move this tip of the microscope to the particular positions. But once you have this, then you can really, with one and the same substrate, do a lot of different types of computation. You can, for example, have this kind of growth structure where you start with the green state, and then it pushes out certain yellow state, starting from this blue crown state. You can have this kind of game of life type of structures that if there's abundance of a certain state, then it will die out, and or if there's too few of these, then it will emerge from a few neighbors only. Or you can have this kind of accumulation that you start with greens, and if there are many greens, they produce red. And so in this way, you can go to more complex tasks. For example, build up this kind of end function. So you have two units formed as a cluster of these low-level units. And if they are there, then they will create another cluster over here. So in this sense, it's quite easy to realize at some part, and usually a well-defined part of the field, this activation. So in this sense, it's much more convenient than the DNA computing, because here everything happens in space. You can move to this particular position and you can see what's going on. It's not really relying on the turbulence of the movements of the molecules that they have a chance to meet, but here it's very, very locally. And essentially, the types of computations are described by cellular automata. So you will have the possibility to realize, I mean, if you want to have an AND gate, it's probably already enough, but more generally, the cellular automata can realize any kind of computer in this way. And once you have 300 units doing so, then this is quite a good start, I think, to have an computation, a possibility for a computation realized in these types of systems. Now here are some other possibilities. So if you activate particular units in a way that they just extend their domain as far as possible, then you just physically create this Voronoi tessellation, in the sense that if you have activated this and this one, it will just tell the neighbors to assume the same state, unless you really arrive at a boundary where all where other ones also have been received the same, have received also the same information. There's also a possibility to put some kind of more global voltage to the system to keep things going or to stop things, in order to be able to deal with these timescales of the system. So this is usually one of the problems, that the dynamics is either very fast, that it's not really observable, or it's very slow if it's relying on some kind of external access to the system. And so here in this, this is another advantage of the system. They found some kind of a nice compromise to have relatively fast interaction with the system, and on the other hand, relatively slow movement in the system, that it's really possible to find out what the system is actually doing. Yeah, so this is this idea of a simulation of a cancerous cell, where we have just a more noisy starting state. And you can really see that there is this kind of transition from a normal cell, which is blue here, to, I don't know, some kind of intermediate stage tumor-infected cells and cells which have started this kind of anti-tumor or tumor suppression programs. And finally, if this is not really sufficiently strong, as in the first case here, then you will end up with the production of cancer cells, which are shown in red. So this is kind of dynamical system, quite complex already, which on this scale can be realized in complete parallel. Okay, so that was it more or less. So there is this kind of necessity to be able to really physically interact with these devices, to have some kind of an possibility to provide inputs or to control the action of the system, to read outputs. So this kind of micro manipulation, or what is also called self-assembly, is that you produce many of these micro machines at the same time, or you have a possibility to design certain bits of the DNA. So there are a lot of ideas going around, but it's probably still too early for money-making applications, so to say. There are a number of other directions which you probably will see in a couple of years, some very nice developments, maybe not so much in the nanorobots, but definitely in synthetic biology, where you can, in a very precise way, change properties of living beings. Quantum computing, I'm not so sure. So this was this number which I mentioned before. There is some progress from 2 to 3 and some announcements of more, but we will not really deal with this. So this is much about a short overview of this kind of nanotechnological business in this respect. It's very interesting that these purely computational approaches have kept many people also in computer science busy for maybe 10 years or so before it turned out that they are very well suited to solve problems which are less specified and where it's not really possible to invest a lot of work to understand the properties better, or where the properties are too fuzzy to be understood in a nice way. But it's very hard for this kind of less good specified problems really to find an optimally suitable algorithm, which is also not really likely by this no free lunch theorem. But also, so there are this kind of arsenal which we have been talking about. There is less no real theory of such algorithms could develop, but in these more practical fields, or more applied fields, if you want to say, it shows much more potential for future developments. And here, these kind of sorts which have been prepared in this kind of computational community, or in this kind of computational studies of similar problems, can be brought back either to biology, like in this DNA genetic algorithms, or perhaps to more physics or material science systems, as in this computation on surfaces, or perhaps also on maybe three-dimensional structures, which are also embedded in some substrate, or finally quantum computing on the lowest level. So in this sense, it's a kind of an interesting development. There is also this possibility, but probably I will talk about this next time in more detail, to perform computations with membranes, in the sense that the properties of living cells are used in order to produce particular chemical compounds. So this has a number of advantages to be able to do so. It's of course, theoretically, it's a computational algorithm, so it can be really mapped to an algebra or to a grammar. And in this way, it's a perfect method for computation, but also as a means for producing complex chemistry, perhaps to provide the compounds which are needed in other computational algorithms. These membrane systems can just are intended also to mimic the function of, for example, the endoplasmatic reticulum in a cell, where there are also different compounds where different stages of complex proteins are produced in this way. Yeah, so I will not do everything today anyway, so I guess we can just stop for today, and I hope to see you one more time next week on Tuesday. Thank you.
Okay. I still have a problem with the assignment.
Oh, that's pity to hear. Yeah.
Yes,
sorry.
Space for T, deficit, sorry, and in this way you will probably